This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Political bureau chief says that the Palestinians' priority is to stop the brutal aggression against Gaza and full withdrawal of occupation forces. International aid agencies warning about the serious repercussions of a decision by some Western countries to cut funding to UNRWA. And Palestinians condemn the assassination of three young men by Israeli undercover forces in a West Bank hospital as a heinous crime against humanity. This is News. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says any deal with the Tel Aviv regime must stop the brutal aggression in Gaza and end up in the full withdrawal of occupation forces. Hamas political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh says the movement is open to negotiations, but an agreement must include an end to the Israeli siege, as well as a genuine prisoner exchange. He made those comments in reaction to a new ceasefire proposal put forward after talks in Paris. The Islamic Jihad movement also said it would not engage in any prisoner exchange deal without a comprehensive ceasefire and Israel's withdrawal from Gaza. The Israeli regime, meantime, has hit residential buildings across Gaza, killing more than 200 people in a matter of a day. 20 people, mostly women and children, were killed in a strike targeting a building in Gaza City. Warplanes also bombed the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza, while residential buildings in the southern city of Khan Yunis were also shelled. The death toll now standing at more than 26,700. The head of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society says the healthcare system in Gaza is on the brink of collapse. Officials in Al Amal Hospital in Khan Yunis say they have suspended surgeries due to lack of oxygen supplies. Hospitals have been a central target of Israeli attacks. The regime forces have also struck ambulances marked with Red Cross or Red Crescent emblem, often in proximity to hospitals. Motia Abu Musabbeh joined us a short while ago with an update on the situation in the war-torn territory.
It's the same scenario that took place in the Shifa complex and the hospitals of the northern parts of Gaza Strip. It's now reiterated in Khan Yunis city, which means that the Israeli occupation forces systematically attempting to paralyze the health sector and collapse the health sector inside Gaza Strip. And the surrounding areas of the complex these moments and over the last couple of hours, the Israeli occupation forces intensified their attacks. The Israeli airstrikes have never stopped for a while the Israeli artillery maintained their constant shelling towards those areas, while the Israeli occupation forces on the ground demanding the Palestinian people to evacuate from those areas to Rafah and to Deir el-Balah city, under the claims that those areas are still safe. In Rafah city, the Israeli occupation forces as well kept attacking the city, and they opened their fire to the eastern parts of the city.
Israeli undercover forces have staged a deadly attack on a hospital in the occupied West Bank, killing three Palestinians. Disguised as medical staff and women, the troops stormed the Ibn Sina Hospital in the city of Jenin. Israel claimed that the victims had ties to Hamas. Hospital officials said the young men were assassinated while sleeping. Following that raid, a general strike was announced in Jenin. The Palestinian Health Ministry also called on the UN to stop Israel's daily string of crimes against Palestinians and health centers. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry described it as a heinous crime against humanity. Hamas also denounced the attack, saying it won't go unpunished. Iran has strongly condemned what it calls a barbaric act, saying it could pave the way for normalization of organized terrorism in the world. Now, several international aid agencies have warned about the serious repercussions of a decision by main donors to cut funding to the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Some 20 NGOs have censured the move as reckless, warning the decision would endanger many civilian lives. The UNRWA also said it would be unable to continue operations in Gaza and across the region after February in case funding does not resume. The UN body has lost half of its budget. More than 15 countries, including the U.S., the U.K., Germany, and Canada, have suspended funding. And that after Israel accused some of the UNRWA staff in Gaza of taking part in anti-Israeli operations. Meantime, Palestinians have condemned the pause in funding for UNRWA as an unjust decision amid the worsening humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip.
We say that it is a condemned and hasty decision. It is a decision that punishes everyone. If what they are saying is correct, that 12 employees participated in October 7 attacks, it is their right after all, as people defending their land. But you don't hold accountable 7 million Palestinians in this collective punishment.
This step that the U.S. and some European countries took unfortunately came as a response to the demand of the Zionist enemy, and therefore it will affect the services of the UNRWA agency that already suffers from a severe lack of funding.
They want to destroy us. They want to destroy the Palestinian people, be it in Palestine, be it in the diaspora, or wherever they are. They surely won't be able to. They stepped into the humanitarian and economic phase. This decision that countries took to pause funding to UNRWA is certainly an unjust decision and can't pass.
We are basically not receiving aid now. So what will happen after the U.S. and other countries cut their funding to the UNRWA? This would mean a humanitarian catastrophe, and it means that the U.S. and its allies are participating in the war of slaughter against the Palestinian people and the killing of the children, elderly, and women in Gaza.
I am sure that there will be a famine or even a disaster here because we are already living in disastrous conditions in Gaza due to the lack of aid.
Israel and Lebanon's Hezbollah have been engaged in intense fighting since Israel launched its onslaught on Gaza in early October. Hezbollah says it's targeted a gathering of IOF troops in Hadab Yaron with missiles, inflicting some losses. Our Lebanon correspondent joined us earlier with details.
It was also very significant that we see that Hezbollah is targeting soldiers directly. We can see how, despite the fact that the Israelis are doing their best to basically move with caution and trying to be careful not to be under the rocket fire of Hezbollah, still it seems Hezbollah has the upper hand when it comes to these capabilities of being able to target the movement and know exactly the movement of the Israeli soldiers, where they are, when they are moving from away from the barracks or into the barracks, and be able to target them. That was, of course, one of the operations. Another operation was near the town of Wazani, and facing the town of Wazani, which is also very close to the occupied Shabab farms. Hezbollah says it targeted espionage devices in that posts specifically. And this is not the first time that Hezbollah targets espionage devices. We've seen that one of their main strategies and tactics that was used also all across the border was that the first thing that they did in the early days of the confrontation, even before the truce, was the fact that they made sure to target everything that is used by the Israelis in order to spy on Lebanon, to take footage, whether it is the cameras or the espionage devices, in order to that are used to jam radios and to spy not only and eavesdrop not only on Lebanon, but also that could reach areas in Syria and Cyprus and even Turkey.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the sanctions and animosity of the ill-wishers could be an opportunity for further scientific progress in the country. Meeting with economic players and producers, Ayatollah Khamenei said that such problems undoubtedly deal a blow to the country and put into trouble. But the leader stressed that the young generation has turned those problems into opportunities, as they have been able to develop military munitions and secure outstanding scientific achievements in such areas as space and also satellite launches. Ayatollah Khamenei added that had it not been for those sanctions, Iran would not have achieved such accomplishments. Tehran and Islamabad have vowed to jointly fight the common threat of terrorism. The announcement signals efforts to rebuild ties following missile attacks on each other's border regions. Yassoum Shahmedi reports.
Very dear brother.
Vowing to fight the common threat of terrorism and reiterating their commitment to improving bilateral relations. Iran and Pakistan are back on the right track to boost ties following tit-for-tat missile attacks on each other's border regions, where terrorist separatist groups have been active.
We are saying this loud and clear for the terrorists to listen carefully. Iran and Pakistan will not allow terrorists to create insecurity in the region. Make no mistake, we are one nation in two different geographical areas, and both sides strongly respect each other's territorial integrity.
In Islamabad, in response to his Pakistani counterpart's official invitation, Hossein Amir Abdullahian discussed ways to fight against the terrorists based along the Iran-Pakistan border areas that are, in his words, supported by hostile third countries. Many Iranian and Pakistani forces have lost their lives in recent years in the fight against terrorism, and over the past 2 weeks, both Iran and Pakistan inevitably launched missile attacks on each other's soil in order to contain the terrorist separatist groups, a move that created a media frenzy. And now this official visit is clearing things out.
You need to understand that in the last 70 years or so, Pakistan and Iran have developed a robust cooperation between themselves. We have strong people-to-people contacts. We have religious ties. We have historical ties. We have cultural ties between our two countries. And these ties are extremely important for our two countries to have a common security and common development, peace and prosperity for each other. I think the important thing for us is that there is a strong sentiment in Pakistan that peace and prosperity and security of Iran is something which is extremely important for Pakistan and for the region. And we have very strong reason to believe that Iran is also motivated by the same sentiment.
Views that were reiterated by Pakistan's Chief of Army Staff, General Sayed Asim Munir, as well as Pakistan's Prime Minister, Anwar ul Haq Kakar, who urged joint efforts, more coordination, and intelligence sharing to fight terrorism as a common threat to both countries, while also extending an official invitation for the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to travel to Islamabad. Iran and Pakistan are turning a new page, and the Iranian foreign minister's trip to Islamabad is a sign that both sides are adamant in expanding their bilateral relations. Yassoum Shahmadi, Islamabad.
The Iranian foreign minister says that the U.S. knows well that a political solution is needed to end the Israeli war and genocide in Gaza and the current crisis in West Asia. Hossein Amir Abdullahian, in a message posted on social media, said the diplomacy is moving forward to end the crises, though. He also underlined that the Israeli prime minister is nearing the end of his criminal political life. Also, Iran's representative, an ambassador to UN, rejected his baseless U.S. allegations linking Iran to attacks on American facilities and personnel. In a letter to the Security Council, Amir Saeed Iravani said Tehran does not directly or indirectly control any group or individual in the region and is not responsible for their actions either. On that, after U.S. blamed Iran-backed groups for a weekend attack that killed three American forces in Jordan. The Iranian Defense Ministry says that the country's space program is completely scientific, aimed at developing technology for civil and peaceful purposes. The spokesman of the Space Department at the Defense Ministry, Ahmad Hosseini Munis, reiterated Tehran's legitimate right to make scientific advancements in airspace. Hosseini also censured negative reactions to Iran's breakthroughs in the field and the recent successful launch of multiple satellites into orbit. He said that such reactions are due to some countries' concerns about Iran breaking up their monopolies in the field. He also revealed that Iran will launch more satellites in the near future. On Sunday, for the first time, the country managed to place three indigenous satellites into orbit simultaneously using the Seymour carrier. Now, China has warned the U.S. against further fueling tensions in the region following a deadly attack on a U.S. military base in Jordan. Beijing says Washington should avoid falling into a vicious circle of retaliation.
We have noticed reports of casualties caused by the attack on the U.S. military base. We have also noted that Iran stated that it had nothing to do with the attack. The situation in the Middle East is currently highly complex and sensitive. We hope that all relevant parties will remain calm and restrained, strengthen dialogue and communication, avoid falling into a vicious cycle of retaliation, and prevent further escalation of regional tensions.
Now, the Chinese spokesman made a comment after the U.S. vowed to respond to the attack on its base in Jordan. The Kremlin has also called for de-escalation in the region. Spokesman Dmitry Peskov says that Russia believes the overall level of tension is very alarming, and it's a time for steps to de-escalate tensions. Americans have held a new pro-Palestine rally in California to press Vice President Kamala Harris to support a permanent ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. Harris was visiting the city of San Jose, where protesters were out on the streets to condemn the Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. The demonstrators also told people who were lining up to see Harris to ask her to support Palestinian rights. Similar events were held in Canada, where protesters urged Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to drop support for Tel Aviv. All right, with that, we come to the end of this newscast from Tehran.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The conversation. Hi, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we look at the topic of our fragile peace process. How does peace now look 25 years on from the signing of the Good Friday Agreement? Has common ground been made by former enemies, or are we as polarised as ever? My next guest served under the Royal Ulster Constabulary. Depending on which side of the political divide you come from, the RUC were seen as the protectors of a community or an oppressive force against another. As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildernew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's guest is Sam Thompson. Sam is a former member of the Royal Ulster Constabulary. He experienced the loss of a number of colleagues and friends and saw numerous killings and bombings during the conflict. Sam retired in 2008 and has expanded on his love of history and is now a lecturer. Sam, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you, Sean.
So, Sam, you grew up not far from where we're sitting now, a very different place from this side of the wall. Do you want to tell us a bit about your childhood?
Yes, well, I came in this world, I was born in the Royal Victoria Hospital up the road, but the first house I was brought home to is Dundee Street, just on the other side of the Peace Line. So all four of my grandparents all lived within about 300 yards from here. My grandfather would have grown up on 9th Street, which runs down into Conway Street. So I was very familiar with that lower Shankill area when I was young, even though my parents moved to Ballysillan. My grandparents continued to live down there, so I was basically brought up in between the two.
And Sam, you joined the RUC. What motivated you to do that, and what was its reputation like when you joined it?
Right, in terms of motivation, I joined it pretty much by default. I didn't really know what to do with my life, and I'm now at the stage where I'm retired and I still don't really know what to do with it.
What year did you join and what age were you?
I joined in 1979. And I was 18 and about 4.5 months by the time I went in. So it was basically the economy here was imploding. The place was rapidly deindustrialising. And it was one of the few things that had any job security. Now, in terms of reputation, there was none of the baggage in the unionist community regarding the RUC. And my first memory of them is actually quite a positive one. I went to Cliftonville Primary School, and it must have been either 1970 or 1971. Our school sports day was attacked by bigger kids from around the Bone area. And the teachers got us off with all the run. Like, they're just coming over and chucking bricks and stuff at us. And feeling absolutely terrified, and the police arrived down in the school, and I remember feeling reassured and safe at the sight of the police uniform. Now, as I got older, 1970s was quite a brutal period, and up around Ballysillan, and I don't know whether it's true or not, but like the word in the school was, if you messed about with Tennant Street or you got arrested, you would get a hiding. And as this will sound absolutely weird to many of your... But the idea that if you're arrested, you're going to get beaten up by the police. Nobody thought this was strange. But on the unionist side of the house, that was very much a thing too. But things have to change. So you can either say, well, that's the way things are, or you can try and change them in a more positive way.
And once you joined the RUC, I'm sure you were a member of the RUC for 28 years then, as
yeah.
Well.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a certain period or a time where... And I'm sure there were many dark times. Mm-hmm. Was there something that stuck out in particular?
Oh, well, there were so many things, like particularly the first lot of years when I was in uniform. You remember, like, the severe incidents, you know, when people have been shot and things like that, and all these sort of bloody things, they tend to stick in your mind. The thing which travels with me the most, and I wasn't even there, was my best friend was killed during a hunger strike. And this is why the sort of Republican celebration of it tends to stick in me a bit. There's a lot of people died during that didn't want to die. And he was blown up on the 7th of September, blown to pieces basically, only identifiable by fingerprints, just turned 20 years of age. And he had been transferred to Pomeroy, and that was his first day on duty. He was there for an hour and 5 minutes. And I still think about him and about that quite often. And then there's other people that know quite well as well. But, you know, you carry these things through your life.
I think we're all scarred by what happened. And I suppose during your time in the RUC, did you ever have the urge to join a paramilitary organisation or were you ever pressurised to do that?
Absolutely not. And even when I was growing up in Ballysillan, which where paramilitaries are very strong, I had absolutely no inclination of it. I can give you a story about how people did get into those sort of things. And so about when I was 16, myself and a friend, we went, but heard that there's this bar in Shankill Road Reserve. You weren't too fussy about what age you were. It's a brown bar facing Shankill Library. So we went in, ordered a couple of pints of harp, sitting there at a table thinking we're great guys. And then somebody comes over and starts, "You all right, fellas?" Starts chatting to you. And I realize what this all is and where you're from, all this sort of crack, who's your father and all this, trying to figure out, well, you're Catholics or not. Like, I don't think anybody who's Catholic is going to be daft enough to go in there. And they say, "Well, what do you think? This place?" "Aye, fine, it's all right." Sure, we can swear you in tomorrow. And I says, "What do you mean, swear us in?" He says, "You're joining, aren't you?" I says, "Joining what?" He says, "The UVF." And they're spat my beer out. So it was the first time I'd been in this place in my life. And within 10 minutes walking in the door, somebody coming over trying to get me to join the UVF. Of course, I never went back near the place. But that would give you some idea how easy it was for people to get involved and that sort of thing.
And just on that, Sam, we're all shaped by our lived experiences.
100%.
And I understand you served in Springfield Road.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Barracks, as we had called it, Springfield Road Police Station.
Yeah.
That, to me, as a child growing up, was a place, you know, you heard stories of family members being tortured, even friends of mine that were in there were beaten. And to me, as a child growing up, the RUC were the enemy. But obviously, you had different lived experiences. You were inside there, looking out.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, well, it's just, it's 1983, and I arrived up in there not too long after the hunger strike, and the place had a very forbidden appearance. It didn't have the blast wall around it then. It just had this wire outside. And the reason it didn't have a blast wall was they put a bomb out there that would wreck hundreds of houses around it, because it was a rare place. You were right in the middle of people. And the yard of it had a big corrugated tin fence, and there was holes in it from where somebody had chucked the hand grenade over. And on a quiet evening, you could be standing out there in the front yard, and you could hear the televisions of people in Vallet Street who, and their living rooms were seriously about 6 or 7 feet from the front yard. So, like, the noise that they must have had from all the police and army vehicles, and it was primarily an army post. Like, the RUC were down in one corner of it, and the army occupied about 80% of the building. So you had like army pigs and stuff like that parked about inside it. The army did the security, and then now and again it was overrun by feral cats, and you would get these squatties running about drowning cats in the toilets and stuff. Like, it was unreal. But in the inquiry office, you had like these bulletproof shutters over the windows. There was no natural light. And then behind it, you had all these old newspapers, must have been stuff to keep the draft out. One day I pulled them out, like, and they were dated from 1972 and stuff like that. As a working environment, it was horrible. It was cramped. The facilities, you know, were grim. It was dangerous. It was noisy. But probably the best bunch of people I've ever worked with there.
We chatted earlier, you had mentioned, and I was amazed at the knowledge you had of RUC men and British Army personnel that were killed just around Springfield Road. Do you want to tell us?
Well, for a start, a George Cross was one in the inquiry office in 1972 when a paratrooper threw himself in a bomb which had been dumped in there. Shortly before I arrived, there's a soldier killed at the Cavendish Street entrance by an RPG-7, a guy I worked with. He is the first one down to attend to him. And the warhead of the RPGs apparently went through the wall, the Sanger, and lodged inside him. Again, the year before, 3 soldiers had been shot dead by an M60 machine gun around the corner in Arras Street. 1979, there was a RUC officer shot dead as they reversed the Land Rover out the front gate, and I think somebody had counted it up that there must have been about more than 20 members of security forces killed within about 30 yards of the front gates of the place. And along the front of the building was like riddled with bullet holes where cars used to drive up and down and spray the place.
Sam, you also served in Tyrone. Was it very different serving along the border, and are there any particular stories or reminiscences that you have from that time?
Yeah, well, rural areas are very different from urban ones. In Tyrone, as a sergeant in the mobile support unit, so though we backed up the local police in Dungannon, we also could be all over the place. Like, we went up to Belfast, up at Ainsworth Avenue, the time the UVF guy blew himself up. that I'm a praetor. But Dungannon changed me. At 1 week, whereas within about 25 feet of three bombs inside a week, none of which went off properly. I remember thinking, I can't do this anymore, I need to get out of this. Because it wasn't too long after two friends that Colleen McMurray used to work with in Armagh, she had been killed in Newry. And another guy, probably nobody's ever heard of, a guy called Billy Evans, he ironically was killed by the army, out the foot patrol up near New Barnsley, and an army Land Rover ran over and killed him. I remember speaking to him a few months before, saying, look, get out of there. I don't believe in much, but I believe in the law of averages, and if you push your luck too long, sooner or later something's going to happen to you. So I think the deaths of those two were preying on my mind, and I thought I need to get a job in headquarters or something, you know, because I'd gone through all these years of sort of near misses and something happening to somebody changed the shift with me and seeing things happen to other people, and I thought it's only a matter of time before it happens to me. So applied for job and training and got that.
We crossed our own paths, me and yourself, through a reconciliation,
yeah,
an informal, let's say, reconciliation programme.
Yeah.
How has it been for you on that kind of journey in reconciliation?
It hasn't made a profound difference. You know, I think as you get older, you start to reflect on life. And there's an old saying, if you think the same at 40 as you did in 20, you've wasted 20 years. And I started this interview by saying I basically come from a couple hundred yards away. And the thought occurred to me one day, the idea that someone should be an eternal enemy because they happen to be born 200 yards away from you or born on the other side of a street from is absolutely absurd. It's absurd. But that's the situation that we find ourselves in here. So I thought of that, and again, occasionally you see these little inspirational quotes, which may or may not be true. There's one supposed to be from Martin Luther King, said that hating someone is like drinking poison and hoping they'll die. Look, I could hate Michelle all I want. You're probably not even going to know, but it's not going to affect your life, but it'll affect mine. And is it going to make me any happier? No. Will it bring anyone back? No. Is it going to make the future any better for people that are children now or unborn? No. So some people, that's their way to get through life, is carrying grudges and resentments and hate. I just think it doesn't do any good, and it wasn't making me feel any better. You know, I, by and large, don't suffer from PTSD or anything like that anymore, and I think this has helped because, in my mind, the war's over. There's other people can't accept that it's over for many, many reasons, some entirely legitimate. They've suffered a lot worse than I have. But as far as I'm concerned, it's the right thing to do. It's not going to change the world, but I think it's up to each and every individual to do their own little bit.
I agree with you, Sam. I think hate is a very negative emotion and very wasteful. And, you know, we all have to move on. So where do you stand on the reunification question? Have you thought about our future politically?
These days I'm pretty agnostic on it. I was always, I suppose, a small U unionist. I wasn't a diehard. Like, I agreed with a statement I heard quite early in my time in the police, where somebody says to me, I'm not too bothered about a United Ireland. What I am bothered about is somebody trying to bomb me into it. Any sort of affection I had for the union died on the morning of the Brexit referendum. That to me is a watershed moment. Because that to me showed it doesn't matter what we think here, you know, it's what England wants, really. I know people say it's a UK-wide referendum, but there's no way that Scotland and Northern Ireland should have been forced out against this will. As Scotland in particular is like a distinct country and all the rest of it. And I also just think it's incredibly stupid. I think that the UK, basically, that they decided to commit suicide. And I'm convinced of that. I think that historians will look back, that is the day when the union was fatally wounded, and it was a self-inflicted wound.
And on that, what would you like to see from Republicans to go that extra bit that would maybe convince you that reunification would be an option?
I think I see a bit of schizophrenia from republicanism. On the one hand, there's this outreach, we want peace. But on the other, there's this sort of like constant propaganda war, which is still being waged, and quite a bit of hostility, continually refighting the troubles. And at some stage, this is going to have to stop. You know, unionists who had relations in the police or UDR aren't going to look upon their relatives as evil child killers any more than relatives. The IRA men are going to regard their relatives and that. And all it's doing is winding people up and giving people an excuse not to talk to them. I think as a society, and I'm not just pointing the finger at Republicans here, it's all over. We need to stop absolutely wallowing in the past. We're not remembering it, we're wallowing in it. You know, I did an article once that Japan recovered from two atom bombs quicker than Northern Ireland's recovered from the Troubles. 15 years after Hiroshima, they were hosting the Olympics and are one of the best economies in the world, because they just decided that we're not going to talk about all this, we're just going to move on, make a better country.
You're still tuned into The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. I'm joined by my co-host, Michelle Gildenew, alongside historian and former RUC man, Sam Thompson.
All right. So, close to where you were born and brought up, yeah. Sam, there's a massive community festival, yeah, called Feel and Bubble, and that came out of commemorating the, or remembering internment, yeah, and then it became a community, yeah, festival as a more positive way of remembering the past. So, you know, do you think that something like that could be replicated? I know it looks at and speaks to people from all political persuasions and none, and it's just such an inclusive festival. Do you know, well, have you attended any events?
I have indeed. I've attended events in the past, and I think it's a very positive thing, because, as I said, I arrived in Springfield Road 40 years ago, and I remember those annual internment things, and it was sort of like that film The Purge. You know, the civilians sort of took it upon the night, anything goes, from both them and the police. Like, there was batting rounds fired in, and they could be written off in a form, which any other time of the year would be, what did you do that for? But those internment nights, it was like ritualistic rioting. And you had people hurt, and you had people occasionally getting killed. So I think that's I'll give credit where it's due. That's marvellous credit, primarily to Sinn Féin, for turning that round, to have a very destructive time into something more positive. Some of the events are more cross-community than others, but that's okay. You know, if I don't want to go to something, I won't. You know, it's like the annual Bobby Sands March, you know, in May or whatever. It doesn't bother me, because I don't have to go anywhere near it. So, yeah, that's good, and I would like to see that being extended across the Shankill and East Belfast, and maybe have a whole summer of cultural events. But, you know, I think those events are worthwhile, because you've now got, you know, unionists going to them, and no, one of the commentators is going along, and it's letting also people in West Belfast speak directly to people that they wouldn't normally speak to. So I think it's all generally quite positive. I know there's a bit of controversy about one or two things, but by and large, I approve of it.
This week, we take a look at the history of partition. How was Ireland divided, and what has that meant for the population of the North over this last 100 years?
The official partitioning of Ireland took place in May 1921 via an act passed by the British Parliament. The original intention was for both regions to remain within the United Kingdom, but the Irish War of Independence led to the South seceding from the UK in 1922. Attempts at legislating the Government of Ireland Act first began in 1886. The Government of Ireland Act of 1920 was the fourth try at establishing Home Rule in Ireland, that is, affording the country a certain amount of freedom to self-govern while retaining its position as part of the United Kingdom. Up to that point, Ireland had been ruled by the UK Parliament via their administration at Dublin Castle. ever since the Irish Parliament was abolished through the Acts of Union 1800. After many attempts at negotiating the division of the 9 northerly counties of Ulster from the 23 remaining counties that comprise Munster, Leinster and Connacht, only 6 counties within Ulster were included in the 4th Irish Home Rule Bill of 1920. This was to ensure a Protestant majority for many years to come. After the 3rd Home Rule Bill was passed in 1912, Ulster Unionists had founded a paramilitary force named the Ulster Volunteer Force, with the intention of resisting the bill's implementation by violent means. Many British Army officers stationed in Ireland resigned, and with nationalists having established their own military army in response, with both sides importing arms, a civil war seemed imminent. Eventually, a trial period of partition was also included in the third version of the Irish Home Rule Bill to appease unionists, but when World War I broke out in 1914, the bill was suspended. In an attempt to take advantage of Britain's distraction with the war, an insurrection was launched by Irish revolutionaries on Easter 1916. Following this rebellion, more attempts were made to reach a compromise, such as the 1917-18 Irish Convention in Dublin, with little success. In 1919, the Irish War of Independence officially began. The Government of Ireland Act was enacted in 1920, and the island was partitioned the following year. Home Rule never came into effect in the south. Instead, the Anglo-Irish Treaty of 1921, which ended the war in Ireland, allowed the self-governing Irish Free State to be created, and thus the partitioning of Ireland became official.
And that does it for another week. I'd like to thank our special guest, Sam Thompson, and our resident co-host, Michelle Gildernew. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
The Ocean of Dua.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll adopt a thematic approach towards supplication, and we'll have a look at supplication from the point of view of different verses of the Holy Quran, and we'll also have a look at some parts of the transmitted supplications as well as the whispered prayers. So stay with us. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajil fa. Brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us in the previous episode, we started discussing about the third constituent of supplication, the invoked one, the Almighty Allah. In the first stage, we said that knowing God affects the believers who take part in supplication. Knowing God, the kind of knowledge that we develop in our minds, influences the hastiness of acceptance of supplication by the Almighty Allah. The kind of knowledge that we establish our a'mal and our awrad on affects the quality and quantity of supplication. So that's why we have many parts of the supplications of the infallible imams, noting the fact that if you do not realize the one whom you invoke, your request, your supplication will not be responded to. So we said that knowing God actually helps us understand the reality of those things we see them as effective in the world. We sometimes see that speed is the thing that takes us to our destination. But if we realize that speed added with monotheism, we will understand that this speed is not an independent factor. This movement is only an intermediary. That's why we have many verses of the Holy Quran, as well as the traditions, focusing on monotheism. They do want to tell us that the important thing about whatever the Almighty Allah has created is that you do not take them for granted, is that you look at them as the created of the Creator, as the creatures of the Creator, not as an independent factor. We had a look at some of the verses of the Holy Quran in the previous episode, and now we will have a look at some of the supplications of the infallible Imams. بِأَسْمَائِكَ الَّتِي مَلَأَتْ أَرْكَانَ كُلِّ شَيْءٍ, we read in Kumail's supplication. I beg with your attributes that have occupied everything. This means even having a look at the principle of cause and effect, for example, even that is created by you. Imam Sajjad alayhi salam says, بِيَدِكَ لَا بِيَدِ غَيْرِكَ زِيَادَتِي وَنَقْصِي وَنَفْعِي وَضَرِّي. It is in your hands and not in the hands of anyone else. Every abundance, every defect, every benefit, and every harm of mine. So the etiquette in worshipping, especially at the time of involvement in supplication, forces us to turn and rely on God and to somehow forget anything except God. This principle, which comes from, originates from the understanding the Almighty Allah, of recognition and knowledge of the true essence of the Lord, is of utmost importance, because if we rely only on God, if we think about nothing else, then we will worship with all our bodies, with all our souls, only God. The Prophet ﷺ has said, يَقُولُ اللَّهُ سُبْحَانَهُ أَنَا خَيْرُ شَرِيكٍ. The Almighty Allah says, I am the best partner. مَنْ أَشْرَكَ مَعِيَ شَرِيكًا مِنْ عَمَلِهِ فَهُوَ لَشَرِيكِ دُونِي. لِأَنِّي لَا أَقْبَلُ إِلَّا مَا أُخْلِصَ لِي. I am the best partner. He who offers some of his doings to a partner other than me, I will leave him to my partner. Because I do not accept save what is offered sincerely to me.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy of God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you Allah, God, let me hear, feeling so good about.
not a dream, this is so true. And we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of Dua.
So this is the Almighty Allah we're discussing, dear listeners. We have to recognize Him truly before we engage in supplication. The Almighty Allah does not like His servants to recognize any partner with Him. He considers this act as a great defect. This holy verse of the Holy Quran says, وَمَا يُؤْمِنُ أَكْثَرُهُمْ بِاللَّهِ إِلَّا وَهُمْ مُشْرِكُونَ. Most of them do not believe in Allah without associating others with Him. So this verse helps us, actually teaches us to set aside the concept of any partnership with God so that our sincere supplications may save us from great calamities. هُوَ الْحَيُّ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّهُ فَادْعُوهُ مُخْلِصِينَ لَهُ الدِّينَ. He is the living. There is no God but He. Therefore call on Him, being sincere to Him in obedience. Sincerity was one of those conditions of acceptance of supplications that we thoroughly discussed when we were discussing the first and second constituents of supplication. Now, it is reported that among the issues which Allah has revealed to Jesus Christ, ala nabiyyina wa alihi wa alayhi salam, is this: Ya Isa, ud'uni du'a al-ghariq al-hazin alladhi laysa lahu mughith. O Jesus, call on me like a depressed, drowning person who has no rescuer. أَذِلَّ لِي قَلْبَكْ وَأَكْثِرْ ذِكْرِي فِي الْخَلَوَاتِ. Make your heart yield to me and remember me in privacy. The Almighty Allah mentions in the Holy Quran the story of Prophet Yunus and his sincere prayer at the time of depression. He said, فَنَادَى فِي الظُّلُمَاتِ أَنْ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا أَنْتَ سُبْحَانَكَ إِنِّي كُنْتُ مِنَ الظَّالِمِينَ. This verse describes the horrible event that happened to Prophet Yunus, عَلَى نَبِيِّنَا وَآلِهِ وَعَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ, who was in the darkness inside the whale's stomach. We will thoroughly discuss the points of this story later on. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَيْكُمْ وَرَحْمَةُ اللَّهِ وَبَرَكَاتُهُ.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye. Allah, yeah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah. Yeah, Allah, yeah, Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you through half my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.